Afternoon. I call this meeting on Human Service Finance Committee to order. Members, we have a quorum present. And with that, I just wanted to begin with Vice Chair Barnett. Do you want to move the approval for the minutes for January 24th?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the minutes for January 24th, 2023.
Thank you so much. Vice Chair, I'm going to move the approval for the minutes of January 24th, 2023. Any discussion? See none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? See none. The minutes for January 24th, 2023 are now approved. Members, today we have a big discussion on the governor's budget, the recommendation that you have. Everyone has got a significant book here, and quite frankly, there'll be a test on Tuesday, so be prepared.
Open book, I hope?
It's an open book.
Okay.
Yeah. And we are lucky enough to have the department here, so just wanted to go through this process, and I would like members to wait for their question after every section, so if you've got any question, please write it down. So we can allow the commissioner and the staff from the department to present the recommendation to us. With that, I just wanted to welcome Commissioner. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and committee members. For the record, Jody Harpstead, the commissioner of the Department of Human Services. Pleased to be here today to show you our budget recommendations coming out of the governor and lieutenant governor's One Minnesota budget. And so let's get right to it. First, our mission, the Minnesota Department of Human Services, working with many others, helps people meet their basic needs so they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. Our budget package is centered around the people that we serve, who are listed down the column on the left. You can read those for yourself. And improving the health and human services system on the right. We have spent much more time in recent years working with our county partners, our tribal partners, providers, and others to develop policy and good ways of working and this budget. So working to create a more seamless statewide health and human services system. The budget package pillars of the DHS budget are to make Minnesota the best place for all children, including Black, Brown, and Indigenous children, to grow up, remaining one of the top five states in the nation for older adults and people with disabilities to live in, transforming the health and human services system so it simply works better for people, taking a stand along with our colleagues in the Interagency Council on Homelessness for racial justice, gender justice, housing justice, and health justice, and increasing our operational effectiveness and facilitating the co-creation of solutions with partners. Here's a summary of our total budget package. It includes $1.7 billion or so for children and families over the budget horizon, about $1.4 billion in long-term care and workforce, and as a reminder, that does not include the amount that's in the forecast. Access to health care, housing and homelessness, and behavioral health, all approximately $300 million. Our direct care and treatment services, $232 million. Our service delivery transformation, which we talked about in previous testimony, about $200 million. Agency effectiveness, 161, and some other things, for a total of $4.6 billion in 103 proposals. So it would help very much if you would save questions for each segment, because there's a lot to go through today.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members, any question about the summary of the total DHS budget? See none. Commissioner, proceed.
Thank you. In case you're curious about which funds we are looking at in the budget, most of it, of course, comes from the general fund, $3 billion, $1.5 or so from the health care access fund, and the rest from the remaining funds listed here on the page. In this committee's jurisdiction, we will be looking at $1.35 billion in long-term care and workforce, $232 in our direct care and treatment services, $110 in behavioral health, and $48 million in service delivery transformation. And so we're going to go over our workforce and long-term care package, behavioral health, direct care and treatment, and agency effectiveness. And I am turning it over to Marshall Smith, the CEO of our direct care and treatment services. Thank you.
Good afternoon and welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed, Mr. Smith.
Good afternoon, Chair Noor, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marshall Smith. I serve as the health system CEO for direct care and treatment. I'm going to present four proposals to you. First of all, DCT program, as far as DCT programs, direct care and treatment is the only behavioral health care system of its kind, size, or scope in Minnesota. We are a complex, highly specialized behavioral health system that provides care to over 12,000 patients and clients each year. Our vision and our work, the work we do is to provide services to those who will not or cannot be served by the community providers. In most cases, the community-based health providers do not have the clinical expertise, staff, or appropriate facilities to care for these individuals, and therefore they come to a DCT. The population served are those with severe and complex mental health illnesses, behavior and substance abuse disorders, developmental disabilities, and those who've committed a sexual offense. And oftentimes, they are a combination of all of these. DCT currently makes up two-thirds of DHS's total FTEs with more than approximately 5,000 staff that provide direct care and treatment to patients in our hospitals, our residential facilities, our group homes, foster homes, vocational training sites, crisis facilities, dental sites, and other outpatient or telemedicine services. Our personnel costs make up 85% of the DCT's total operating budget. The first proposal that I'm going to share with you is DC 40 on page 77. For the most part, DHS is a policymaking agency that regulates and pays for services, whereas I previously noted, DCT is largely a behavioral health system that provides a wide variety of inpatient treatment programs, residential and vocational services. Again, serving those people who are mentally ill, developmentally disabled, and have chemical dependencies. With these distinctions between the departments, this proposal best positions DCT to function independently and operate like other large health systems if established as a separate identity. Separating DCT from DHS is not a new idea and has been proposed by state lawmakers, mental health advocates, and other key stakeholders who've long recognized that both entities would benefit from separation. This is evidenced by the numerous bills lawmakers have introduced in the past. There are numerous operational benefits for DCT and DHS should they separate. To mention a couple of them, it would make the health system more agile, allow for clinical and operational decisions impacting patient care and services delivery solely by people who have the clinical and healthcare experience. Historically, this has not been the case. It erases the conflicts of interest, real or perceived, that are inherent between DHS, who acts as a regulator for DCT. It reduces the administrative burden of complying with DHS's governance requirements and standards that do not apply well to healthcare operations and the regulatory atmosphere under which they operate. It also provides greater transparency of funding, results to patient outcomes, and more direct line of communication, education, accountability to stakeholders, labor partners, political leaders, and the general public. It also allows DHS to focus on a range of other concerns, including child care, people who reside in communities with disabilities, seniors, and vulnerable adults, healthcare policy, and managing and regulating the massive federal programs around Medicaid. The second proposal that I'm going to present is DC 42, DCT operating adjustment. This request increases total base appropriations for direct care and treatment for the fiscal year 24-25 biennium. DC treatment facilities provide 24/7, 365 days per year to all patients. And because of the nature of the work, the facilities providing critical services and by necessity, staff-intensive operations. Again, and not to sound repetitive, but important to know, is our personnel cost for the 5,000 employees throughout Minnesota makes up 85% of DCT's expenditures. This proposal is being addressed today due to several factors that include inflation at historic levels, increased cost of salaries and benefits, and efforts used to mitigate staff shortages, facilitate recruitment, and retain new and existing staff. This adjustment will maintain and stabilize DCT operations and avoid a reduction in service. If funding is not received, DCT cannot maximize its potential to serve more. It may need to even reduce services because our complicating factor right now is our workforce. The third proposal I'd like to present is DC 41, Program Enhancements. DCT is always looking at a better way to serve people, and like our acute care hospital systems, we need to look at how we support people once they leave our facilities or to minimize the return to the state system for institutional care. This investment is for the ongoing stability and safety of provisionally discharged patients and clients living in the community and to provide support and to avoid returns to any DCT facilities. It also maintains inpatient substance use and addiction treatment services for people civilly committed for chemical dependency. These outcomes can be reached by expanding outpatient clinical services, by addressing the outpatient needs for those who've been in DCT facilities but do not have the medical or psychiatric support to remain stable and successful in their activities of daily living. It further addresses our need for crisis support teams in outstate Minnesota to help patients avoid costly readmissions to DCT facilities or ER visits or unnecessary stays at community hospitals. And it stabilizes funding for our substance use disorder program so that we can continue offering the treatment services we provide without reduction of inpatient beds. And the fourth proposal is DC 45. The electronic health record. At the heart of this proposal, it is to enhance patient care and safety. The funding and success of a full implementation of the electronic health record will put us into compliance with many of the regulatory standards outlined by CMS, the Joint Commission, and other regulatory bodies, while aligning us to be like and functioning efficiently as other healthcare systems that do have an electronic health record. It will allow for portal services, so internal and external providers have access to pertinent patient information for the ongoing and the continuity of care. This will lead to more successful outcomes by ensuring the continuity of care because of the deterioration of patient care often starts when treatment, medication management, and follow-up appointments are not followed. The EMR provides a centralized approach to patient information located in one system, removing the reliance on paper and maximizing the technology to get a full patient record at hand. There are also many other benefits, and just to name a couple, providing patients and their guardians with access so that patients' health information can be supported by families or guardians for the continuum of care. And it allows us for the generation of health data to identify health disparities, develop more culturally tailored treatments, and address inequities.
Member questions on this section? I know I've got a couple of questions. So to start with, wanted to know more about the timeline for the transition. I know we have the children families transitioning DCT, which is not a secret. We've been talking about that transition for many years. For many purposes. So what do we anticipate, when do we anticipate the timeline will come out for the transition of DCT from Department of Human Services?
Our proposal presented that it would be July 1st of 2024 that we could have the transition completed. So between now and then, about 12 to 18 months.
12 to 18 months planning to do the transition. Will this be a cabinet level so that everybody is aware of? Is this going to be a cabinet level or is it going to be direct responsibility under the governor?
It would, right now, I believe it would be direct responsibility under the governor.
The other question that I have for you is, I know if we try to expedite the EMR because we really need it, we failed to deliver that last session. Can we include a budget that's more specific for this fiscal year? I know we have a few months left. Will there be an opportunity to expedite? Do we have the tools that are necessary to implement a portion of the EMR as soon as possible?
We are prepared to work with our vendor company to have that implemented over 12 to 24 months.
12 to
24. And that is that's a time frame that we establish, but that could be expedited pending the funding availability.
Thank you so much, Mr. Smith. I know we have a lot of questions and we're planning to do, but I know members have got questions. We'll start with Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you for being here today. I just had a question about page 435, the operating adjustment. I don't see Myth Homes on here anywhere. And I know Myth is a little bit different because it has, you know, a variety of sort of funding streams. Is there any proposal to increase funding for Myth providers?
Mr. Smith.
Representative Hicks, I'd have to go back and look at the details to outline and would be glad to bring that information back to you.
Great. Yeah, I didn't see it on the fiscal details. Oh, sorry.
No,
sorry, Chair.
I'm sorry, Chair.
I just didn't see it on the fiscal detail, and I wanted to make sure that we weren't leaving our providers who provide community-based services to some of our most challenging kids out of the conversation around rates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will keep my questions relatively high level since that's what we're doing today. First question, and it may be for you, Mr. Smith, and it may be for Commissioner Harpstead as well. My question is, by separating out direct care and services, what's the intention? How is that going to help shrink DHS and provide more efficiency within, I mean, I think we all have been talking about this for years, right, that it makes sense to have some split. But I'm wondering how now we're going to make DHS more efficient, shrink that by moving this out.
Mr. Smith. Oh, Commissioner Hogan.
Chair Noor and Representative, the proposal does not shrink DHS, what's left of DHS after DCT splits away. We've been testifying previously that we need additional administrative support with all of the proposals coming our way, the additional grant money that's been coming our way in recent years, and so splitting the two does not cause either of them to shrink. We're not talking about eliminating any jobs on either side. And in fact, we're going to need some additional support to continue to do all of the work. If I could, I just wanted to make one more comment. We've been very careful about talking about the reporting relationship after the split until the governor had a chance to announce his budget, but now he has. And so the proposal actually calls for a board-led organization with Mr. Smith here reporting to a board. Think of Mincher in terms of the structure. So there would be a board appointed, and Marshall Smith would report to that board, just as we do with Mincher today, is the proposal.
Lady Newburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is really concerning. You know, we had an OLA report several years ago around the time that we were overpaying both the tribes and the counties. And, you know, as the legislative auditor was trying to get to the bottom of that situation, one of the most significant problems they had is that they dealt with 8 layers of middle management to get from the commissioner to the person who theoretically was a decision maker. And I'm really concerned that all we're doing is growing government here. We're not necessarily making it more efficient. It's not a new cabinet level position. This seems like a difference without a distinction. So that is really concerning that while we're considering splitting, we're not considering the efficiencies and how to streamline what we're doing to provide better services. Just growing the bureaucracy, growing the agencies is really concerning. One other question, well, actually, two other questions very quickly. Program enhancements, the program enhancement slides, there are $0, at least on this slide, there are $0 associated with it. What's the intention for doing that without additional funding?
Yeah, some of that is used within our existing appropriation of how do we build services for those patients that we currently treat that have been discharged. And then our CARE program, which is an enterprise service in which we bill for those services, we would like to use some of the MSOX money to fund that piece of care to make it whole. So there's really no dollar allocation as much as the way we are using the money.
Lead Newburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. It's always good to think differently about how to deliver care and see if we can do it better with what we've got. That's wonderful. Last question on the electronic health records. Is the intention here to create an entirely new system? Or will, I mean, because obviously there are tons of existing very good health record system. Epic comes to mind. My late husband was an Epic super user. What's the intention with that?
Yeah, Chair and Representative Brindley, we would use our existing system, which is NetSmart. And the DCT has a good start of an investment using the NetSmart product. And while I personally have had experience with Epic and many other EMRs in my career, this system is designed for behavioral health. So it certainly will meet our needs as well as have a portal effect with Epic. So there'll be the ability to intersect and be interoperable between health systems. So we would use the current system, and the money that we're asking for is to invest in what we're already doing, but to fully implement. Right now we're about 50% paper, 50% electronic.
Final follow-up, Lead Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly appreciate the goal to go in 100% electronic. 50% paper is crazy nowadays. NetSmart, is that something that was created by DHS, or is that a market product that you've purchased in our?
It's a national company that works on behavioral health systems, and they're also integrating much with Epic. To address Epic facilities who don't have a behavioral health product.
Lead New Burnley, we will be bringing an IT, hopefully, package, because I think we need to invest in the infrastructure and how we do services. As someone who's used the Epic and other products, you know, in the market, so I think this is a smart way of doing business and also efficient way. And quite frankly, the transition of DCT out of DHS is the most efficient way of doing services. And I'm assuming there'll be billable services to the department so that there's more transparency in the work that is happening between DCT and DHS. With that, I wanted to allow Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Two questions for Mr. Smith. First question is, with the proposal that you have coming forward, will that help address the capacity system in the direct treatment? And what I'm getting at is that I hear from hospitals that so often they need to send people to direct care treatment facilities, and there are no beds available, not necessarily that the beds aren't there. There's no staffing. So wondering how much of that problem is going to be addressed with this proposal. And number two, if inflation had been figured into here, how much of this amount that is being asked for would have been covered if we would have already had inflation built into the budget?
Mr. Smith, and also, what is the wait time for anyone to be placed in under the service? Please proceed.
Yeah, we do have a breakout of wait times. I don't have them with me, so I could certainly get that information back to you,
that will
Chair.
Be appreciated. Thank you.
Chair, Representative, to answer your question about addressing capacity, in our budget proposal, our appropriation is to meet the current needs based on our current volumes and the staffing that we have. We need to maximize that first by hiring and recruiting into those positions so that we have a full staff. If we move our patients out that don't need to be there, we would probably free up about 50 beds to treat people more quickly. But our waiting list today is about 300 people.
Thank you, Chair Noor. And how does going to the question on inflation, if we'd have built inflation in over time into our budgets, how much of the request that we have here now would have already been built in instead of having to come back and ask for additional funding?
Yeah, Chair Representative, I would have to either ask Elise to help me with that.
Ms. Bailey.
Or come back to you with some details.
Chair Nor, Representative Fisher, we could definitely run the numbers for you on that.
Thank you, Chair Nor. Thank you. Yes, I'd be curious to know that because, you know, I've heard over time from other presentations here where some of the limits that we've had in the department is instead of filling positions, we're using those dollars to cover inflation elsewhere. And I think it's important for us to have a better understanding of what are those dollar amounts really on a year-to-year basis type of thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Nor, and thank you for your presentation. My question is a follow-up to Representative Fisher. The hospitals are having a hard time discharging in every community. Nursing homes and assisted livings also need placement for behavior health, sexually inappropriate residents, mental health, addiction type things. My question is, are you taking admissions right now from nursing homes, assisted livings, hospitals, or is it bottlenecked at your level too?
Mr. Smith.
Chair Representative, our admissions are primarily by referral. So a patient that meets the criteria for hospital level of care, that we have specific criteria for that. Most of our referrals come from hospitals, doctor's offices, community health centers, counties. That's where our primary referral base comes from.
Thank you. I just have a follow-up. So I'm assuming that you have, are you surveyed then for your vulnerable adults like nursing homes and assisted livings? Do you have annual surveys too?
Yes, we, Chair, Representative, yes, we do. We are surveyed by both DHS licensing, Minnesota Department of Health, Joint Commission, and at any time we could be surveyed by CMS.
I have Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, again, thank you, and Mr. Smith, it's good to see you. I'm sorry that I was a few minutes late, and I wanted to just ask the question about the DCT, about the CABS hospital again. We are doing a much better job today with getting our census up to about 50%. I think it's just below that right now. We built a brand-new facility a few years back, built it for 16 beds, but really never funded it completely because we didn't have the funding at the time. In this budget, have we increased the funding to utilize more of those beds with the, you know, realization that we're doing a better job there now, whether we can get to 12 beds or 16 beds? Are you moving that in that direction for that particular institution? And if you said that earlier, I'm sorry that I missed it.
Mr. Smith.
Yeah, Chair, Representative, you know, CABS is an important part of our system, being a, you know, a small hospital for children. We went from, you know, 2 to 3 admissions to we're averaging about 6 or 7 right now. So as we increase census, most of that inability to increase census is because of staffing, having a lack of a provider, the lack of the right personnel to help care for those children.
Just to follow up, I know that, but the budget was never set up for beyond really 8 to begin with. So I want to make sure that if this budget is going to still grow there, I'm hoping that we're going to budget in that area so we can fill and use those other beds. I want to know that what I was told by DHS in the last few years by your folks, and you know I'm working closely with that facility and you've got a great bunch of people there, and I knew there was a ceiling coming. I'm asking, are we raising that ceiling so if we can find the workforce, the budget is there to support it?
Yeah, I would say that right now our budget is at 8.
And finally, currently in this budget, you're not increasing that?
I have not increased it for this year.
It's disappointing. Disappointing.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being with us today. I want to start by a note of gratitude. So I have actually carried the bill. So I really appreciate the questions from Lead New Brindley, because you know, this is a bill that I carried last year and will be carrying again this year, and I want to say just a note of gratitude in that DCT, in our conversations, it is one thing to face up against a legislator, it is another to face up against a 20-year veteran of the IT industry, a project manager and software development manager, and get grilled on the intricate details of why you chose one product over the other and who did what and what's your timeline and what is the scope and what are your increments and when are you going to deliver them. And so I will say I have seen incredible growth in the department in just the last 8 months in terms of defining the scope and the maturity of the organization and really laying out the plan for where that EMR is going to go. And I am so grateful for that. I do want to say also that I am really grateful that I know you're as new executive, having new executive level leadership over there, that there's been an extensive amount of research to make sure we had the right product for the job. And to dive a little further, I know there was a question about why Epic versus the product that you chose. And I know that Epic is a great product, but it also is a little more expensive. And it does not have some of the customization for behavioral health that you alluded to. And I know that I grilled you all about that particular topic pretty extensively. So thank you for being very gracious, and thank you for the question from Representative New Brindley, because I know it is a good question. It's a great question. So just wanted to say thank you, express my gratitude, and look forward to continuing to do that work with you.
Chair, Representative, I'd just like to say thank you for your support as well and your interest.
We have one final question, and then we'll proceed after that. Representative Zalesnik.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker and Fisher, and thank you. I'm deeply concerned. We have a pillar of caring for children as number one, one of the number one for the state. And this 8-bed count concerns me because I know we have children who are in hospitals who have not seen sunlight for months because they can't get placed. It's just not acceptable. We have to have a better plan, and we as a committee have to find a better. I know for a fact. I know doctors who are calling me, asking me what is happening from the cities, from Minneapolis, St. Paul, all the way up north. And it is, they cannot do one-on-one in a hospital setting, in the ER. So we need a plan. Holding them in an ER bed, and as a child, 8 and 10 is pathetic. So I asked this committee to find solutions, and I have no further questions.
Thank you so much for your comment. I think we've got a lot of work to do in that aspect, and also I'm hoping that we'll get the bill for that separation of DCT and to be able to get through the committees here. So thank you so much, Mr. Smith, for your presentation. So we move to the next section. Ms. Morty, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Representatives, my name is Kulani Moti, and I serve as the DHS Inspector General. And so I will be going over the proposals related to the Office of Inspector General. First, a little bit about us. The Office of Inspector General, or OIG, manages the licenses programs such as family child care, adult foster care, and mental health centers. We manage the financial fraud abuse investigations, and we conduct background studies on people who applied who work in these licensed or regulated settings. So the proposals that I'm going to start off with today is our regarding our background study proposals. So DHS conducts background studies for over 70 provider types with over 35,000 active providers. The number of background studies applications received annually has increased 45% since fiscal year 2018. The volume of background studies determinations completed has dramatically increased year to year from just over 225,000 determinations completed in fiscal year 2018 to approximately 370,000 in fiscal year 2022. Due to a recent fee increase in our agreements with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, or the BCA, the current legislative established fee of $42 no longer represents the average cost for us to conduct the study. So this proposal addresses the escalating cost for DHS to conduct background studies and criminal history searches by bringing the background study fee in alignment with the actual processing cost by increasing the fee by $2 for most study types. It also grants DHS the authority to increase fees by the amount the BCA increases fees in the future, which would align with what the authority that we have regarding our FBI fees. It also allows DHS to recover the cost of tribal background studies for adoption and child foster care from the general fund. Without a fee increase, there will end up being a structural deficit in the special revenue account, and DHS may be unable to meet all of our statutory obligations. And then our other proposal around background studies is regarding our background studies operational costs. So critical and essential background study functions are being performed without the corresponding infrastructure and increases in staffing capacity, which are needed to ensure DHS's statutory obligations are met. The insufficiency in infrastructure and staffing capacity is impeding the provider's ability to respond to their ever-evolving workforce needs and the provision of services to the state's most vulnerable populations. It delays background study determinations. It hinders our ability to respond timely in responding to incoming caller inquiries. It could create our sizable backlog of studies. It exposes risks related to the quality assurance and the quality controls of us conducting these studies. It creates an inability to mitigate risk and the excessive costs associated with us maintaining our systems with software and developing new systems, and limits consistency in our stakeholder and provider engagement. This proposal funds new background studies positions to support Minnesota's workforce needs and to protect the safety of children and vulnerable adults. So our next few proposals. Yes.
Before we go there, I think Representative Kilo's got a quick question.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Thank you for this. We've been talking about background studies and the barrier that it creates, particularly in my community of Moorhead, which is the largest, fastest growing community outside of Minneapolis, St. Paul. I find it really concerning that we have to drive 45 miles to an hour just to get one way, just to get to a background study location. So in this, in your adjustments, how are you making sure that this is accessible? Because this is the first barrier to employment. If we can get through our background checks, or people aren't driving, I mean, greater Minnesota, we're really good at driving through bad weather, but I don't think that we should have to. And in some of the instances, the people that we're hiring maybe, you know, don't have access or the extra time to do that. So can you talk to me a little bit and share what you're going to do about the accessibility barriers that we have around background checks?
Ms. Vaughn.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we're aware of the challenges that with our fingerprint locations, specifically in the Moorhead area. We have a sole source contract with IDEMIA, which is our fingerprint vendor, to be able to come in and administer fingerprints statewide. And we have numerous measures within our contract, performance measures for them to perform at, in order so that we can make sure that accessibility is addressed in that. And so one of them is to ensure that there is a fingerprint location within 35 miles of a study subject's either place of employment or where they live. And so and if that is not being met, we are working with, and I'm holding IDEMIA accountable to address that immediately, and in the meantime to bring in resources with that. So we'll be able to follow up with you separately, specifically about the Moorhead area, because I do know that there was a change in the fingerprint site there, but we do have measures within our contract with IDEMIA to address that, and I know, and we can follow up with you after on that specifically.
Last thing, 49 and a half miles is the distance, actually, so we're out of that. We had no notification that they were closing. There's been times that they've shut down early when appointments were set, and so I think we need to look in how we hold them more accountable for the things that they say that they're supposed to be providing for our communities. Thank you.
And just also wanted to follow up. I think there was a background study that was done, and we're hoping this committee will hear about that, and some of these issues can be addressed during that conversation. Representative Kwok.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought in the past, or I know in the past, there have been issues of some people having to get multiple background checks because they weren't sharing, you know, there wasn't a repository of where you get it, it's good for X number of months, because I know people that had to go through
they're sort of sub for people leaving for vacation or maternity leave. And so they're long-term subbing in several counties over a period of time. And every time for this program or that program, they had to do a background check and get the charge. The other thing is we're paying some outside entity to go around and do fingerprints. You think we've got law enforcement that can do fingerprints in those locations locally. You might as well see, maybe you fund some FTEs to give some extra work and have it done there. Or maybe you have a regional person that goes from law enforcement location, you know, in the towns, and then you can schedule it. I mean, there are ways of providing service in greater Minnesota that doesn't require big contracts to some other entity that don't have the service that we could do if we just got together with the people we're used, you know, right in our area. So that's a suggestion maybe for someone to, you know, do an amendment somewhere. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Well, we actually, as part of our customer, we don't clap in the
that was some exciting
part of our tradition here. Well, I know we've got a lot of work to do, and I'll, that was just more of a comment on what that needs to be done. I'll let Representative Baker follow up.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. And with your comments, too, just before Representative Quam spoke, it sounds like we're going to have a whole hearing on this issue. Is that correct? Because there's a lot of issues on background checks that we have to dive into. I want to know where the work group is at. I want to know that we're cleaning up the people that are wanting to do great work in these fields are being not allowed to do so. We have got some serious issues. So I'll hold my comments if I know we've got that coming up, because this is a really important item that our workforce is getting decimated and needs that they don't have to be. So I'm counting on you to have that, so appreciate you doing that. I'll hold my comments then for later.
We'll follow up on that. So, Ms. Moore, please continue.
So now I wanna present on our proposals regarding our licensing area. So this is for our critical resources for licensing. Licensed programs and investigations have increased significantly while staffing has failed to keep pace with this growth. This proposal strengthens core functions of DHS licensing, which includes licensing and oversight of home and community-based services, child and adult foster care, and child care centers, as well as maltreatment investigations and the department's ability to respond to urgent program needs to ensure continuity of services for vulnerable adults and children. This proposal will benefit license holders, applicants, and vulnerable adults and children in licensed programs by allowing for more timely licensing reviews and maltreatment investigations, quicker responses to questions, concerns, and complaints, and more expeditious processing of applications. If this proposal does not pass the legislative session, DHS licensing will continue to fall further behind on processing our licensing applications, conducting our licensing reviews and investigation, and most importantly, fail to protect the vulnerable adults and children receiving services. On our operation, our Op 78, home and community-based services corporate license application. So this proposal is addressing two problems. The first is that that individuals and then our non-individuals or otherwise corporations pay the same application fee for an HCBS or home and community-based license. The second issue is that the DHS HCBS license application fee is far less than the Department of Health or MDH's application fee for a comprehensive home care provider license, which is a comparable license. And since the license fees are different for the two departments, applicants may apply for the less expensive license instead of the license that more aligns with their businesses. So this proposal increases license fees for these corporations or non-individuals applying for an HCBS license and will create a more equitable fee structure for HCBS license applications. And it will account for the resources used to process applications from non-individuals and align the fee with MDH's comprehensive home care license. If the fees align with MDH application fees, applicants may be more inclined to apply for the license that best aligns with the services they are equipped to provide. And then our Last one is Op 81, which is streamlining of our behavioral health regulation. So the Uniform Service Standards, or USS project, is a multi-phase reform of the regulatory structure and service standards of mental health services in Minnesota. The next step in this reform project is to begin to create a single comprehensive licensing structure for mental health service program. This will improve the integration of behavioral health services, reduce the administrative regulatory burden on providers, and will ensure clients receiving services under consistent requirements. This next step for the USS project is to transition the regulation of certified community behavioral health clinics, or CCBHCs, and the services they must provide from the various processes in our behavioral health division to one standard licensure process in the licensing division. Phase two of the USS project would transition the following types of services to licensure under the jurisdiction of licensing division by January 1, 2026. Would be those CCBHCs, the children's therapeutic services and supports, adult rehabilitative mental health services, mobile crisis, and community mental health centers. This proposal includes a direction to DHS to make this transition. Statutory changes to accomplish this complex transition will be introduced in the 2025 session after extensive stakeholder collaboration. These positions would fund positions within licensing division to monitor the requirements of these newly licensed providers, and it also pays for modern systems to track the different services each organization is approved by DHS to provide. That's what I have.
All right. Thank you so much. We have a few questions, and also wanted to let members know that the mics are picking every sound, so with the books and everything else. Just wanted to give you a heads up. Every small sound is being picked up. Hopefully we can fix the audio from the external system. First person I have, Lee Newbin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, just maybe a silly question, but on your presentation on these different slides, you have a reference OP64, OP70, OP76. What's that referring to? So I know what I'm looking at here, or what I should be referencing.
Chair and our representative, that's our kind of an indicator for each proposal we have, and it's more probably more relevant when at the end of the day you see the tracking and all of the math. So sorry, it's probably not in the book and nothing you can reference at this point. So
okay,
apologies for confusion on that.
thank you, Mr. Chair. So not relevant for us necessarily. It's just internal, you guys know what that means.
Yes.
Okay, great. Question on the home and community-based services, the license application fee. So you're changing that fee to try to sort of encourage folks to apply for the most appropriate license. How is that playing out right now? What are the ramifications right now of applying for something that might not be the appropriate license? What are the regulatory issues you're running into? How's this playing out in practical terms?
Ms. Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative, on this. So what we're starting to see more and more is the length of time that it is taking to work through an HCBS application. So it's requiring significant technical assistance from our licensors to go through that process, to answer questions, finding out and leading more towards that they don't have the correct competencies or the ability to provide the necessary HCBS services that would fall under our license and may be more appropriate under a home care license. And so that's increased all that additional time and questioning and going back and forth has increased our processing time from about 27 days to process an application in 2017 to 164 days on it for us to then realize or get to the point where we're actually denying the application because they don't have the competencies to provide the services under an HCBS license and it would be more appropriate under a home care.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's not really playing out in, like, regulatory problems. People are not actually receiving licenses that they shouldn't have. So are you then, in addition to just changing the application fee, are you changing something at the beginning of that process to help people understand which license would be more appropriate to avoid that. I don't think that simply changing a fee is going to solve that problem for you.
Ms. Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. Some of the licenses are denied, but some of them then do, or some of them will get by or go to the point or get to the minimums and actually get a license, and then we are seeing regulation problems that they're not actually able to perform to standards. So then we have increased monitoring and oversight and corrective actions, and we're going out because they're not actually fully able to perform at that level on it. And we have done a lot of technical assistance, providing information on our website as to what is expected, a lot of examples of things and what people will need to do to try to help with that, and then direct people over to the MDH site into their license. So we've done a lot of what we've been able to or up to right now to try to educate people to say this may not be, you know, look at these things, look at what you're required to do. This is what you would need to have in order to apply for or to obtain this license. And so we've done that as best we can, and we're still seeing that this is continuing to be a problem. We think aligning the fees would help with that.
Mr. Chair, last thing.
Last follow-up.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm concerned there. So you're saying that people meet the application requirements and they are given the license. So again, the problem is not with the fee. There is a problem with the process in licensing if they are actually not capable of performing the work under that license. So it still doesn't solve that problem. And so I would just remind folks that even in the definition and statute, a tax by any other name is still a tax. I mean, calling it a fee, this is a tax, and we're increasing a cost without, it does not sound like we're actually solving the problem.
Ms. Motti, if you wanted to comment on that, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we'd be happy to discuss more, and I can provide some more of that additional information regarding that, your questions and your comments about this.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. Quick question here, just to kind of piggyback off of Rep. New Brindley. Just talking about aligning fees, in our community, in my community, in some of the town hall meetings that we've had, the huge daycare center that we had that supplied so many opportunities for families, along with several home-based daycare centers, it had nothing to do with the fees and application. It had much more to do with just the regulations. And that if we don't get curious about the bottom, like how we can serve our communities, serve people to help their families, and in the, it's discouraging to me to hear that it was 27 days to find out, could I have a viable business as a daycare provider, for example? Two, now I won't know for 164 days. I'd be curious to know, is it because the state employees are not boots on the ground in the office? They're, you know, are they home? I've asked this question, you know, several weeks ago. Are state employees home? So they're not there to take and do all their daily activities, going out to see the people. But it's a huge concern, not only in our, you know, like in my community, but our regulations in Minnesota have been ridiculous for to even be enticing to want to open and operate, and, you know, to the level of care that they could do really well, but especially with being shut down so many times and all the regulations during COVID, just all the unnecessary close contact, then the whole place shuts down. And there's not enough money that would go around to help these places stay open. So it wasn't for the lack of people wanting to care for others. It's because we've made it so complex in Minnesota, and politicians have hopped in to make it so complex that we need to kind of look at why people are not doing these jobs.
I'm glad the commissioner will be talking about the subtraction, as we've been talking about. I don't know if that is for the commissioner or Ms.
Oh, I was going to say, Mr. Chair, Representative, a couple of things on that. That's part of the reason we have our critical resources for licensing proposal on there is the added service lines under our home and community-based licensure have increased, but our staffing hasn't kept pace. And so some of that, our licensors are out in the field, and we're not into the field for a shorter time within during the pandemic, and we did get them back out in the field in transition to that as soon as we can. But that's part of it is that specifically in our home and community-based licensing unit, the number of licenses that we have issued and the providers that we're regulating, as well as the additional service lines that have been added since the 245D license was enacted, have not kept pace. So that is part of what we're asking for on that, to specifically address reducing those application times and application resources there for that on it. And I believe we have, we're looking at up to 31 licensors or 31 FTs specifically to address that. I know it's probably not the jurisdiction of this committee, but in regards to our child care, I just want to say that we do have a child care modernization project that was funded, I believe, in the 2021 legislation, and that we're undergoing a project to specifically look at the regulations for both child care center and family child care, because they have not been updated for almost 30 years, and so we are undergoing an entire project looking at that. There's heavy stakeholder engagement, and we will be coming back with recommendations to the legislature on how to reform that and update that. So I just wanted to share that.
Well, thank you, Ms. Moore. We want to fix the mic, and then we'll go.
Oh, is there something wrong? I'm sorry.
No, it's the volume, but we appreciate you. We'll move to the next section, but I'm sure you will be here to answer any questions. So. Is it fixed? The last question, Representative Franson, and then we will proceed to the next level. So you got it. We think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm glad that my communication through my eyes portrayed. I just have a comment, less than a question, but we heard a fascinating presentation, I believe. I'm just going through my text messages because I found it so fascinating, on January 17th that I had to contact Representative New and see, like, what's good for the goose. And that was the title of my text, in case you're wondering. But the presentation had a comment about one of the needs of DHS's biggest possibilities for our partners. And so this ties in with the comment that Representative Gilman was bringing about regarding regulations, right? So DHS is wanting to subtract unnecessary rules and regulations that don't impact health and safety or prevent fraud or abuse for a time of workforce shortage. So if it is good for DHS, Mr. Chair and members, to reduce some of those burdensome regulations, then I believe that we can also do the same in the areas that DHS affects, including our child care provider friends. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your comment, Mr. Franson. I think we'll proceed to the next presentation. Ms. Mertz, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record. And any questions, please, after we finish this few sessions. We've got less than 30 minutes left, so hopefully we can get to questions after.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon. My name is Natasha Mers, and I am the Interim Assistant Commissioner for the Aging and Disability Services Administration at the Department of Human Services. So I'm pleased to be with you all here this afternoon to talk about the long-term care workforce issues that are plaguing our home and community-based services system and our long-term care services and support system. I'm sure members of this committee are aware that we are in a workforce shortage and crisis that's impacting people's ability to get access to needed services and supports, particularly people that are living in their own homes are finding it immensely difficult to attract and retain workers that are willing to come into their home and provide needed supports and services. And we see these dynamics as our population is aging and the people that will be 65 and over continues to increase while the number of people to support them is decreasing. So this year, the Walz administration is taking a multifaceted approach to addressing this significant problem to stabilize our long-term care workforce. So the budget recommendations that I'll be walking through with all of you today include a wide array of rate increases, including disability waiver rates that support over for our seniors that support over 40,000 older adults in Minnesota, as well as disability waiver rates and other measures that will make it easier for people with disabilities to join the competitive integrated workforce and attract people into the long-term care workforce. So the first proposal that I want to share with you is a historic rate increase in our personal care assistance and our community first services and supports program once that's implemented. This increase will impact about 20,000 home care workers in Minnesota and provides also rate increases, but also increased wages or increased rate increases based on experience. So providing some of that career ladder up in terms of rates. It will also create a more robust orientation program that will help people feel fully prepared for the important work that they will do after becoming a personal care assistant or CFSS worker. And it also includes admin funding and additional investment to cover provider training and stipends for attending the provider orientation and other training. It also includes an enhanced budget for people that utilize the self-directed or the self-directed model under the waivers as well. And the next thing I'm really excited to share with you today is the Older Adult Long-Term Care Workforce Package, which includes some really necessary rate increases to our elderly waiver program, which serves, again, about 40,000 older adults in Minnesota, as well as rate increases in the Alternative Care and Essential Community Supports Program. This also has a component for our self-directed option, consumer-directed community supports, which is a program available under the waivers that allow people to leverage their informal and family supports and pay them using Medicaid dollars. So this proposal includes an increase in the budget for people on EW so that they have more money to utilize to either pay higher wages or pay for more services, depending on what they decide. Next proposal is capacity and workforce expansion. So this includes permanent funding for two grant programs that will expand the depth and diversity of our workforce, improving recruitment and retention for both culturally specific providers or providers that serve typically underserved communities, which includes the rural Minnesota, understanding that that's a particular challenge. And a new grant program that will focus on recruiting and retaining immigrants, refugees, and new Americans for long-term care work. Goals for this include being able to really help people that are interested in long-term care but are new to America or new to Minnesota to really understand and work with an agency to be able to do career counseling, job readiness, and things like that. So the goal there is to, again, sort of increase the workforce or bring new people into the workforce. The next one is phase two of our Vulnerable Adult Act redesign, which is a really important continuation of work from previous sessions. And it's this is phase two of a multi-phase plan to strengthen and expand the Vulnerable Adult Act statute to improve safety and dignity for over 55,000 people in Minnesota who have disabilities or are older adults and are considered vulnerable adults. So it has also within this package foundational funding so that our tribal nations can establish protection services for tribal members rather than having to work through counties or other types of pass-throughs. So this is really an exciting component of this proposal to really continue to enhance and keep our commitment to tribal nations with that true government-to-government structure and requirement that's built into state law. I think we'll keep moving. The next proposal is really also targeted or pointed toward rural Minnesota, and that's the revamping and enhancement of our critical access nursing facility program. So this is a program that is designed to ensure that people in Minnesota don't have to drive an unreasonable, distance in order to access nursing home services, that they could be admitted if they need services into a facility that is reasonably close to their committee or reasonably close to their communities. So this proposal adds funding to those critical access nursing facilities to enable them to respond to workforce pressures, have a little bit more financial flexibility in that service model, and it's it's estimated to impact about 15 rural nursing facilities and roughly 500 residents of those rural communities annually. And the next, kind of building off the vulnerable adult tribal component, is the establishment of a tribal elder office in the Aging and Disability Services Administration. So the goal of this is to allow DHS to provide more and better technical expertise on navigating the variety of streams of federal funding that tribes have access to but may not have the capacity or to access right now. So this gives us the ability to have dedicated resources that are liaisons to tribes that have, you know, technical expertise in home and community-based services and Medicaid, as well as the Older Americans Act, and work with tribes on whatever the tribe wants to do in terms of becoming an LTSS provider or performing lead agency functions or just being more leveraging federal money more efficiently without having to, you know, have some type of a county-based pass-through. So we're really excited about this and, again, really reinforcing the implementation of that true government-to-government collaboration or that government-to-government status that our sovereign nations hold. And these next proposals are related to improving the assessment experience for people with disabilities or improving the functionality when they're in a particular program. So HC 67 is really about streamlining and adding resources to the state medical review team, which is a team that processes and determines disability status for people that make application to them. So it's a necessary step for someone to access other disability services like home and community-based waivers and other services. So using additional funding and resources to streamline the process, make sure that this team has the resources it needs to process eligibility accurately and effectively and provide customer service when documents are missing or things need to be established to establish that eligibility. And then similarly, for the medical assistance for employed people with disabilities, makes changes to conform with federal law and provide some resources to shift the IT platform that we're currently using into a different one, which will streamline processes and deduplicate a lot of kind of workaround work that we're doing right now within our current system. So this is also a subtract proposal in the sense of streamlining the process so people can pay their premiums, understand if their premiums are not paid, get their eligibility status, and things like that much more easily. All right, and thinking also about the importance of rate increases on the disability services side of the world, 8070 functionally updates the timing of the disability waiver's automatic inflationary update. So it basically gets that rate increase into the hands of providers sooner using a different date than what's currently in statute. It also implements a database rate methodology for intermediate care facilities for persons with developmental disabilities to ensure people that live there are aging in place and are not forced to relocate during staffing shortages. So shoring up some of that methodology to make sure that payments are appropriate and allow people to remain in those settings for as long as they would like to. And workforce sustainability for people that live in their own homes. So this is a proposal that has a few different components to it. It includes rate increases for our positive support service, which is a really important service for people that live in their homes or communities that have maybe behavioral challenges or need positive supports in order to be really successful in their community. So it increases rates to attract new providers into that service line. Enhances or increases the homemaker rate to align with current EW rates, and also includes a component where we are adding to the cost reporting or to the labor market surveys that we do to support cost reporting. And in this change includes getting direct feedback from the direct support professionals themselves. So currently it's the management entity or the provider that's completing the cost reports that then go and support recommendations on rate updates. And we also thought it would be really important in a workforce shortage to make sure that we're hearing directly from the direct support professionals on those things. So this proposal includes some admin funding to make those changes to our current system, as well as increasing some funding for the Disability Hub, which connects people with disabilities to resources, tools, as a one-stop shop where they can call someone, they can chat with someone, they can email and get information about their services and benefits, or if they want to talk about what employment looks like, or if they're having trouble accessing housing. The Hub is that central resource for them to get started and get the right information at the right time,
as well as investments in Direct Support Connect, which is an online job board that helps people that want to hire home care workers find those home care workers and make good matches. So we'd really like to expand that program to include profiles in different languages and have more functionality and user usability. And this one is also a really important proposal. It's increasing wages and workforce participation for people with disabilities. So it's making certain reforms in our system to further align how we pay for services and what services Medicaid pays for to come into line with Employment First policies. And our Employment First policies are sort of the foundation of how we think about employment for people with disabilities, which that competitive integrated employment is the first and expected outcome for people with disabilities, and that people can work if they have the right supports in competitive integrated environments if they so choose. So this proposal has investments in both training, technical assistance, and other things that will make more inclusive work sites and increase wages for people with disabilities, some of whom are currently earning sub-minimum wage. So this proposal does propose a phase out of having the disability waivers pay sub-minimum wage in 2028. And this package is really composed of a sub-minimum wage elimination task force that has been meeting over the past year. And so this package is coming forward on the recommendation with the components of that really important task force. And finally, proposals, well, not finally, almost finally, workforce technology investments. So investments in grant programs to help people purchase technology that can reduce reliance on human assistance when that's appropriate and something that they prefer. So enhancing and improving the, expanding the outreach or expanding the capacity of that program. And then for our EIDBI, which is an acronym that is long, but really this is our autism service, our state plan autism service. And so the component of this proposal is making sure that we add culturally responsive services, particular to American Indian communities, by allowing those providers to access current payment incentives in the rates and recognizing that those communities are culturally specific and should have access to that enhanced rate when the provider has the qualification. This proposal also funds a study for licensure options for the autism or EIDBI service. The service is currently unlicensed, and obviously adding a license can bring a lot of quality measures and important things, but it also can sometimes be complicated, and so we really want to understand for this particular service if a licensing structure is foundational and really what the future of this service needs, or whether maintaining its unlicensed status is really the best way to go forward. And looping back a little bit to focus on culturally specific services and care, this establishes, AD 66 establishes a grant program to support customized living providers in transitioning to a home and community-based services license. And the genesis of this proposal really was hearing loud and clear from some of our smaller providers of assisted living services who felt very squeezed between the establishment of the assisted living license and the different funding limitations on the CADI and BI waiver. And so really what the services they're providing are really important, and they're providing excellent service, but we want to help them move into the home and community-based service license type when it fits the business model that they've established. And so these programs are designed to help with that transition for providers that choose to make that transition over to home and community-based services rather than assisted living. It also contains a component for assisted living providers that are closing, that there's a special payment methodology to make sure that they have enough operating revenue during their closure process, which generally is there's a minimum 60-day notice requirement. So to make sure that if and when a provider does close, that there are funds available to make sure that transition is smooth, staff get paid, people can stay there until they found another residence and location. And then the establishment of a life-sharing benefit and family residential rate tiers. So this is a service that we've been working on for many years and excited to bring this forward as a discrete service and under Medicaid. So life-sharing is designed to be a relationship-based matching program where someone
matches well to a person that uses services or a person with disabilities or a senior, and they agree to provide certain services and they're and live together and share a living space, and they the person that is, you know, providing services is then paid through Medicaid through the rate setting methodology that is included in this life sharing service.
Well, thank you so much, Assistant Commissioner Merz. So we'll proceed to the behavioral health, and then we'll get some more time to ask questions.
Thank you very much.
Chair Noor, there's actually one more slide in this.
Please proceed.
Yeah,
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be very brief. These last two proposals improve the assessment experience for people in lead agencies. One, MnChoices, is for the MnChoices process. So it includes some ongoing funding to make sure that we can make improvements to the user interface for the revised MnChoices tool. And we've got some base funding to be able to respond to what lead agencies tell us they want to see, what would make the assessment flow better for people if we need to make changes to the actual technology application, as well as an important study to look at presumptive eligibility, both financial and functional, for our home and community-based services or our LTSS population. And finally, planning for innovative and community-driven workforce solutions. So this also includes a study to help us understand how we can move certain services that are currently available only under our waiver programs into a state plan authority or a different federal authority that allows more people to access them. And these services, such as positive support, crisis respite, and specialist services. So these are services that very much help people that are in crisis stay in their communities and stay out of the hospitals or de-escalate a crisis when it's occurred. So we think that by expanding, if we can find a way to bring these into a more expansive federal authority, that more people will have access to them, and that will be, you know, one strategy to manage, you know, some of the significant hospital overcrowding that we're having and people not being able to move through the HCBS system.
Thank you so much, Assistant Commissioner. Now we move to Assistant Commissioner Grumdon. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Eric Grumdahl. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Behavioral Health, Housing, and Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services at DHS. Happy to be with you today to present the governor's budget proposals related to behavioral health. I know that we are compressed for time, so I will try to also compress what's a lot of content here, and appreciate your help or guidance with that. Our DHS's behavioral health programs serve 300,000 Minnesotans each year, and those services span a wide spectrum, ranging from early intervention and identification services through the most intensive and residential options that are needed to respond to the array and range of behavioral health challenges Minnesotans face. Next slide. The first proposal to share here pertains to the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council. This has been a really significant venue for harmonizing a variety of different perspectives around what's needed to address the crisis that we have in opioid overdose deaths and use of those of opioids. The proposal here really helps to focus ORAC's membership on the communities that are most directly impacted by that epidemic, and so make sure that the membership of the committee really reflects the communities that are disproportionately impacted, as well as targeting resources that are allocated through ORAC to respond to the needs of those communities. It also adds a couple of important specific activities that would be funded out of the opioid fund, and with that, we think help strengthen what has already been established and position us going forward for an even stronger response to the opioid crisis. Next slide. This proposal is really around helping to improve and increase and expedite the access that Minnesotans have to our behavioral health system. It includes expanding the range of partners that are able to provide and bill for comprehensive assessments. It also launches a public awareness campaign in part to help Minnesotans who are seeking treatment or other forms of support know the ways and the paths to be able to get access to that support. It provides an important expansion in two programs, housing supports for adults with serious mental illness, or HSASMI, and the programs for assistance with transitioning from homelessness, or PATH, programs that right now have a limited eligibility focused on individuals with mental health crises and broadens that to include individuals whose primary challenge may be substance use disorder. It also provides important funding to expand adult mental health initiative funding and capacity building to the White Earth Nation. Next slide. The behavioral health proposal 46 is really around kind of continuing in this theme of subtraction and simplification, trying to streamline the delivery of the regulations pertaining to the delivery of behavioral health services, focusing on changes that would be most helpful to focus only on the things that are either required from a safety, health, life, or prevention of fraud, waste, and abuse perspective, or that are aligned with our larger movement toward the American Society for Addiction Medicine, or ASAM, standards for treating behavioral health. So really is intended to help streamline the experience for practitioners and providers in this field and align with what we know is most kind of emerging and critical in the delivery of behavioral health services. I'm also excited about the way that this proposal includes building a team within BHDH, the Behavioral Health, Housing, and Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Administration, that will really help leverage the data that DHS has available to help providers, counties, tribes, and other partners be able to really make the most use of that data to guide program refinement, policy development, or other kinds of improvements, bright spotting and hot spotting and that kind of thing. So very excited about that proposal. The next set of proposals is really around improving access. And so this is about making sure that strengthening the paths for young people, children, accessing children's residential facilities when that is not via a child protection entry point. It provides an increased rate for adult day treatment. Adult day treatment services are often a really critical step down from a more intensive service, and so a really important bridge in helping to make our entire behavioral health system function. It provides some additional tools to help people connect with the behavioral health services that they're seeking, and it grows the school-linked behavioral health grants that we know have been so important to meet the behavioral health challenges of students in Minnesota. The next package includes, and apologies, I'm going at such a brisk pace in the interest of time, some important expansions in our mental health crisis services and early intervention services, including an expansion of the funding for first episode psychosis programs, and continues our grant funding and strengthens our mobile crisis supports in a variety of ways, as well as expanding the infant and early childhood mental health consultation program to include schools as partners in that program. The next proposal is really around addressing what we know are these critical, and as you've seen across our proposals, workforce challenges by being able to build on some proven interventions that we know are helping to increase and diversify the behavioral health workforce, including the really impactful cultural and ethnic minorities, minority infrastructure grants, or CMIG grants, that have not seen an increase since they were created, but have been a really critical way to help make sure that the behavioral health workforce in Minnesota reflects the individuals that are seeking behavioral health care, and that those practitioners are supported in entering the field and staying in the field. Two more sets of proposals. A set of proposals here related to sober homes, really helping to codify and strengthen the way that sober homes are implemented, and even just to have a statewide registry of those sober homes across the state. And so a critical piece of helping to reinforce that part of our behavioral health continuum. And finally, a set of proposals related to recovery community organizations, or RCOs, that are really designed to help strengthen that part of our behavioral health continuum and provide resources that help build the quality of those programs and their sustainability across the state. So apologies for moving at such a brisk pace, but I hope that was helpful, and those are our proposals.
Thank you so much, Assistant Commissioner Grumdahl. You did an excellent job in keeping us on time. We will have extra 10 minutes, members, to ask questions, and then we'll be done by 2:40. I know, Bailey, I just wanted to know, I think, to be clear, in terms of the PCA increases, I'm really glad to see that we are investing in that. Is it the 16.88% increase on overall what we're paying right now? Is it 21.88% 0.98% on that aspect?
Mr. Chair, let me look real fast.
Page 27.
Thank you.
While you're looking, I just wanted to mention thank you to Sebastian Gonzalez Navarro, who's our CLA, and also Mr. Tenzin over there for putting together this booklet for all of us. As you can see, they've done an excellent job, so thank you. I think this is the only time that I'll thank you so much for the help. We can follow up on that.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I've got it. Yes, so there's a few components in this proposal. One, there is an immediate rate increase starting 1/1/24. That is compared to current law, that would be at 16.88% for all PCA services. Then on January 1st, 2025, that's when we'll be able to implement that really innovative tiered rate structure where the rate will depend on how much experience that the actual worker has in the field. And so that will kind of depend, the rate that the provider receives will really depend based on that.
Can we get the breakdown? Because I know by statute, I think PCA and CFSS, there's 75% required to be spent on the employees, and how we came to that 16.88% so that we're able to understand the traditional versus the choice and many other aspects of how that budgeting can fit into the narrative of where we want to be. Because this is an excellent part of our discussion, what we'll do. Also wanted to know more about the DWRS, the changes that are coming, including the elderly waiver. Likewise, I think there's conversation about the customized living, including the nursing homes. I think we will have more conversation how all those aspects come together. We want to make sure that everyone who is in long-term care, you know, we can pay well, better than some of the other, you know, fast food areas, so that we can attract and retain employees in all these services. So we'll have more conversation. I know there's more to digest. I will allow the other members to ask quick questions if they have any. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we can get the data later. I just, on what you were just talking about, it'd be nice if we had a cash fund account to where these positions and others, if your retention of 5 years or 3 years, you know, there's a bonus they get, and that retraining and replacing is such a cost. But getting into the presentation on slide 24, pages 208 through 210, I think you're missing some zeros, because having four facilities close a year, the aging population in rural Minnesota, I think there's more of a need that I don't see, you know, in the dollars that you've got specifically there. Slide 31, 217 through and 263, I'm confused, because in the tails, you've got a cut that's of a magnitude of 3.5 times what the budget number was. It'd be nice to know more in detail where you came up on that. Slide 39, pages 277 through 282. Frankly, I'd like to see some partnering with schools and youth groups, because they probably would be good to interact with for efficiencies and more timely interactions. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your comments and question. Did you want to briefly respond to that, Director?
Chair, Representative, we can gather all that information for you.
All right, thank you. I have Representative Cortez-Otun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had a couple of questions about the employee retention survey, and just kind of some of the information we're hoping to glean from folks. I mean, we already know that they are very underpaid for the work that they do. It's critical work, essential work for so many of our Minnesota residents. And I'm curious, I mean, I know that many of these folks work independently with their assigned clients, and I'm curious if there is any sort of social aspect or cohort connection that either the department provides, or if we offer any sort of incentive for other organizations that we contract through to provide, because I think that it can be really lonely work, and it's certainly hard work and emotional labor, and I think that, you know, we can all probably relate to that, whether it's this job or our previous jobs or outside jobs, and having a colleague or a coworker just to be there to vent after a challenging experience or a really great day. I think that really can go a long way in helping folks keep at it, be able to come back the next day and have somebody to celebrate with or have somebody to vent with. And I'm just curious if there's anything like that in either in the survey or already in existence.
Director Bain.
Chair Knorr, Representative. Yeah, I think the point of the survey is for us to really understand from the point of view of the direct care worker, what is your experience? What are some barriers you're facing? But what are the kind of the joys that you experience in the survey? And also as a way for us as DHS administering these programs to continually improve how we run the programs. I don't know if Ms. Mers has additional context on whether we have relationship building programs with direct care workers.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for that really important question, because I think you're raising a really important point about our self-directed workforce, right? So I think you had mentioned that correctly, that there are programs within Medicaid where people that use services can recruit, train, hire, fire if needed, their support worker, and they are able to do that from their family, from their communities, from different sectors, and there are a few limitations on that. But I think really focusing on how is the state providing support, a caregiver support for a caregiver in that sort of unique context where they're really working often with one person that they have a previous relationship with. So certainly would be happy to have, you know, more conversations about that, but did want to point out that as a part of the implementation of the collective bargaining agreement with SEIU in the past, I had mentioned that there are stipends for workers to attend trainings, and we have some increased funding for that in this proposal, but there has been funding for training and stipends for workers to attend trainings in past contracts, and within those, there are definitely coursework where people that are in self-directed workforces come together to learn about, you know, mental health 101 or caregiver stress. So there are a couple efforts out there, and I think they certainly could be improved, enhanced, and expanded, but a little bit of that is true today. But I just wanted to thank you for raising that issue.
Thank you, that's really helpful. And actually, when your comment about how you're, you know, as a part of this, we're looking to expand, that kind of just piqued my interest and made me think of it, because I wasn't sure if that was a self-paced type of training or if they would have interaction with other folks who are going through that same training at the same time, because I think that could be really important.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. I have Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Mers, thank you for your information. I've got a question on slide 22 where you're talking about the two grant programs. And I'm wondering if you can just describe those programs a little bit for us. Let us know how those function exactly.
Assistant Commissioner.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, would be happy to. So the provider capacity grants were funded under the American Rescue Plan with one-time money, and we are implementing or in the middle of implementing that grant program. And the goal of that grant program is really to develop new providers in the home and community-based services sector, whether they're serving culturally specific communities or serving people in greater Minnesota where access to services is more necessarily limited than it might be in the metro area. So it's really designed for those providers who maybe are thinking about starting a business or want to do a particular thing but don't know how to do it, to be able to get technical assistance from a, you know, a vendor that's funded through that grant program, and be able to really walk through different service options and figure out, you know, what is that right fit and right match for what they want to do. And existing providers can also do sort of service expansion or moving into a new business area. So this proposal would fund those provider capacity grants on a permanent basis in the base rather than just the one-time money that we're administering right now. And I'm really pleased to report we just closed our second round of proposals that we asked for, requests for proposals, and first round we got about 150 proposals, and this round we got about 400. So we're really excited with the take up and want to make sure that we can fund these programs long term and have the administrative resources to be able to continue to provide technical assistance and really be more hands on with emerging providers.
Do you have a follow up, Lead Newbin?
Yes. One, I've got a couple more questions, Mr. Chair. One, so this is for expanding and new providers. You know, we've lost 2,400 beds in long-term care facilities over the last 3 years, and I'm concerned a little bit actually by our level of creativity here. It seems like there are probably more streamlined solutions to bring back some of those beds. This just seems like an odd way to do that, to try to bring back those beds. And what about the other grant program?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. Let me start with, I didn't answer fully your question, with the new grant program, and then I'll pivot to the second question that you asked. So this new grant program really is focused on bringing in new people into the workforce and taking advantage of people that might be new to America or new to Minnesota, to try to incentivize them and make it really easy for them to choose a career or a job in the long-term care workforce. So it includes funds to, pay provider, to pay different grantees with different expertise working in the refugee and immigrant space, as well as, you know, building up capacity for home and community-based services providers to be able to figure out how we can quickly add new workers to the workforce. For your question related to the first grant program, I would say that the provider capacity program is focused on new home and community-based services providers, so its policy objective for this particular proposal is not necessarily to find different ways to fill beds that are going unfilled or beds that have closed in the long-term care system. That's certainly a very significant problem. It's just that this particular grant program isn't designed to address that problem.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. I think it also addresses that we have the lowest unemployment rate, so we're targeting new people because there's no way we can find employees. We've got so many jobs that need to be filled, so this is more targeted to get new people to move to Minnesota or be able to, those who are coming in, to find the skills necessary to get to work immediately. Lead Newbern.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be interested to know what percentage of employees in long-term care are currently actually immigrants and refugees and new Americans. I, having worked in that industry, I found that most of my coworkers, particularly as nursing assistants, were immigrants, which I thought was really great, and it provided a really good opportunity for folks, and they were wonderful workers. So I'd be interested to know what the percentage of employees are currently, and if we are solving a problem there that is not necessarily mismatched. My next question is actually for Mr. Grumdahl. I just have one question for Mr. Grumdahl.
Assistant Commissioner Grumdahl.
Thanks so much.
Mr. Chair and Representative.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. My question is, on slide 35, the opioid funding, this sort of uniquely, it seems like most of the funding across the board in this DHS budget goes up in 26 and 27, and we're decreasing funding for opioids here. Can you talk to us about that, please?
Chair Noor, Representative, yeah, you've pointed out a kind of an oddity in this proposal. So last session, the legislature passed a revamping of the statutes around ORAC to enable the state to pull down the settlement funds that we were finally getting from the opioid lawsuits. And there was a drafting error that occurred that was discovered, of course, after the bill passed. And it basically resulted in us not being able to receive some of the settlement money that's just sitting in the account in the state coffers. So what the majority of that funding in the first biennium is doing, or half of it, about six million, is just changing that cross-reference error, but we're tracking it as a cost because right now under current law we can't draw down the funds. So it's kind of an anomaly in that aspect.
And as I understand, Representative Baker and also Liz Olson are working on fixing that. So there's a bill coming forward. So the next person in line is Representative Zalesnica, and then we'll have Hicks, Representative Hicks. Final question.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you for being here. I'm going to speak as a past CNA, and I was a CNA through COVID for many, many shifts. So while I'm thrilled to see money coming into long-term care assisted livings, PCAs, this whole thing, I think we need to fundamentally ask why people don't want to be a CNA, why they may not want to be a PCA, and money will not solve that. So it comes down to regulations, and I'll give you an example, because 40 years ago I started as a CNA at 16, and I could have easily been fired in today's world by the way the regulations are written. And that is, if the care plan is not followed in our field, a field of healthcare, we're caregivers, if you have reason to believe neglect or abuse has happened, reason to believe, neglect. So that means if I'm the aide and the state of Minnesota has determined the parameters of when people stayed home during COVID for being exposed to COVID or COVID positive, and so now we followed those rules as a provider, so people are home. There's no second and third line to bring in like hockey to staff. So you have one aide. Now I'm working a double shift, and I've been working a double shift as a CEO many times in COVID. So now I have numerous people to take care of, but the care plan says assist of one. So when you bring Millie to the bathroom, because they all need to be toileted, I have to stand by the toilet for 30 minutes, 45 minutes, whatever it takes. Can't rush people to go to the bathroom. If I leave to go help somebody else screaming, and I genuinely, because I'm a caregiver, I have a heart, that's who goes into this, I did what I thought was right, and that person fell, maybe they had a laceration, needed stitches, maybe they had a seizure first and then they fell, I don't know. There's a million scenarios. Or they broke a hip. Now, as a provider, I can tell you what we're doing. We're reporting to vulnerable adult an injury. We're getting surveyed, we're getting fined, and the providers are terminating that great employee. So if you're an employee and you're a great caregiver, why would you want to work someplace where you're being labeled as neglect? That's not something I want on my resume when I'm going to do whatever I'm going to do. So I think it's a shame what we've done to our profession, and I'm just going to say it out loud because I'm here for the profession. And we need to get health occupation classes back in the high schools, and we need to start incentivizing people and bringing respect back to caregiving, because it used to be respected, and I still respect all of them that do it. But it is a very punitive system we're in, and we are fined. Their facilities are being fined, and I've asked for the amounts, and I'm waiting for the amounts to see what the fines are. Those hundreds of thousands of dollars of fines have taken facilities' ability to pay staff, buy food, all the things that we did. And we need to look at the big picture. So I encourage the Department of Human Services and Minnesota Department of Health and all of us as elected officials to look deeper, because that's the real problem solver here and the missing puzzle. And I don't know how many in this room have been an aide, but I can say I have. And I just was one real recently, living 16 hours on a dementia unit because there's nobody to come in. And it will happen again. And the biggest population's coming through, and we're not ready. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Representative Lesnica, for your comment and statement. We value the work that many of the care providers are doing. We'll have more conversation about this whole process. Just wanted to thank the commissioner, the director, and the assistant commissioners, and also Inspector General for the presentation. Members, you can take your booklet. We'll have more conversation, and there's some few things that's not included. So with no further agenda items, we're now adjourned.